kind of like plowed about that deep. Each time you take an additional class, you plow deeper. So most of you know the story of Ruth in the Bible. What I want to do this morning is plow a little deeper. That's one goal. The other goal is to show the wonderful story of salvation. So the first part of this is going to be a little messy. I'm just trying to fill you in on some details. So hit the next slide here. Next slide. There we go. I've got a few maps of these. Where the circle is where this takes place. If you'll notice, that's the crossroads of the world of both the Silk Road and the Frankincense Road. And I'm going to kind of, so next slide. So we come in a little deeper. Frankincense was grown around here. And you go, so what's important about frankincense? Well, the pagan religions, they burned children. They sacrificed children. When you burn something alive, it turns into something that stinks bad. The Romans also burned their dead. So you put frankincense with the funeral fires and make it smell better. Also, they didn't have flush toilets and good disposal systems. Marsh and I did a bike trip to South China in the late 90s. You could smell the villages before you got to them. So things that smelled nice were good. So there was this massive frankincense trade from the Horn of Africa and Southern Arabia up through there. Now, I tell the story in Econ, why do Arabs hate Christians? Now, notice I didn't say Muslims hate Christians. I said Arabs hate Christians. 1.5 years, frankincense production was used in Augustus Caesar's funeral. Now, if you're in a frankincense trade, that's a good thing. Okay? Think of that. So, Romans burned their dead. They were pagans. Christians come along, and what do Christians believe? We have a resurrection, so the body has value, so frankincense doesn't. And around 300 AD, the frankincense trade collapsed. Arabia was operating on a one-commodity economy. So they went into a 300-year recession. 300 years. Wow. Do they remember that? Yes, they do. Now let's look at the Middle East. Their economy consists of oil and they're back in the one-commodity economy again. So if we can come up with a substitute for oil or not needing oil, what does that do? They've seen that before. So from 380 to 680, Muhammad came up in 680, so it was 300 years before Islam. So it's not necessarily a conflict between Muslims and Christianity. It's an economic thing, or part of it. So right now what you're seeing in Afghanistan probably dates back to some of the feelings from the frankincense industry. Okay, go on, next slide. Bethlehem, you can see it on the map, and then Moab. The Moabites were descendants of one of the sons of Lot. The other was an Ammonite, and you can see Ammon north of Moab there. So, distantly related, I actually found a distant cousin of mine. We have a common grandfather from 400 years ago. He lives in England. I wrote him. That's kind of neat. But are we really related? Not really. So, probably speaking a different dialect, if not a different language, might have looked different because the other people they were around. But anyway, Moab's not that far from Bethlehem in a straight line, but you had to go up through Jericho and back down. Next slide. There it is again, showing the trade routes. So let's go back to the trade routes. So if Ruth's father-in-law, who comes up in this story, was involved in agriculture at Bethlehem, and they have a famine, maybe he goes over to Moab and gets in a trucking business. Now, Job came from that area east of the Jordan. It says in the book of Job he had 7,000 camels. What do you do with 7,000 camels? What have I taught you? Haul frankincense. Or silk. There was an extensive route in coming in from China and India also. So, next slide. We see this here. If you're smart enough and you get up in the morning and the wind's blowing out of the southwest, what's the weather going to be like? Hot and dry. If it's blowing out of the east, what's it going to be like? Kind of damp and foggy and stuff. It's called an upslope condition. Being a pilot, we have to learn all this stuff. So here's the Mediterranean Sea. The wind blows, if the wind's blowing in from the sea toward the east, it'll blow up the hills. This is where the Philistines lived. That's where they were rich, besides the shipping industry. And this is the Judean wilderness on this side. And you can see it on the other side over here. So if you're on this part of the Jordan Valley, it's going to be dry. If you cross over to Moab, you're getting the upslope conditions again, so it's going to be wet. So why did Elimelech move from Bethlehem over to Moab? It could have been because they had rain there and they weren't having it there. So if you have an exceptionally dry year, you have no rain in Bethlehem, but you might have rain in Moab. Also the trade routes. So am I digging a little deeper in the book now? Okay, next slide. Okay, let's learn some names here. Naomi married a man named Elimelech. He was related some way to Boaz. Now, I'm going to make some assumptions here. Economists do that. They make assumptions. Just to understand the story better, this is not provable, but it's kind of a thought. Salmon, it's stated in the book, was Boaz's father. Salmon married Rahab. Remember that story? Now, one commentary said there might have been a few generations between them, but I'm not so sure. Rahab wasn't Jewish. Ruth comes from Moab. She's not Jewish. So how Jewish was David? But anyway, so let's assume for the story, it'll help the interpretation better, that Salmon and Elimelech were brothers. Boaz was a nephew of Elimelech. Now, Elimelech had two sons, Malchon and Chilion. Each one of them married Ruth and Orpah. We'll talk about them a little bit in the story. All three of those men died. Okay? With me? So we have three widows. This was Moab, and this was Bethlehem over in Israel. Next slide. See where we are. Okay, we talk about wheat harvest. So the way they would harvest wheat is you'd grab a bundle of wheat and then cut it off at the bottom with some sort of sharp tool. We call them sickles, but it depends what they had. If they didn't, can you imagine brass sickles? You'd be sharpening it all day long. I cut some wheat for Mary for some decorations this year, and I used a pocket knife, and it got dull exceptionally fast. So it'd be hard work. So you take your stalks with the wheat on it, and you put it on what, in essence, is a basketball court, and you beat it, you walk oxen on it. There's a verse that says, don't muzzle the ox. That means if he wants to eat some while you're doing this, let him eat some. Next slide. Then after you get the grain crushed out of the stalks, then you throw it up in the air, and the wind blows the stalks away, and or chaff. It's also called chaff, and the grain falls down, and then you sweep it up. Now, in the Gideon story, he was in a wine press. Now, normally you put your threshing floors up on a hill. A wine press is a hole in the ground. This stuff itches. It's really bad. So can you imagine being in a swimming pool, throwing that stuff up, and having it come down your collar? Okay, next slide. And then they separate. Here they've got the straw on one side. They'll use the straw for fuel. But they've got the grain there, and then they eventually eat that. Okay? We use it in bread and pasta and such. Now, do you feel the work that goes into getting to this point? Is there a temptation to steal it? You bet. And I'll talk about cats and dogs. Dogs do jobs for people. What do cats do? They eat mice that are eating your grain. So what do you do with the cat? You try and convince the cat to come out of the desert into your farm and take care of the mice. So what do the cats do? Well, what do I get for it? So you wonder why cats act the way they do? Okay, next slide. I think that's about the end. Okay, yeah, this one. There's a stage in this story that takes place in the gate. Now, the top picture is the outside. This is the Damascus Gate at Jerusalem. Now, this is going to shock you. That architecture there is contemporary to Santa Fe, New Mexico. The Ottomans rebuilt the old city of Jerusalem at about the same time that Santa Fe and St. Augustine were being built in the New World. So, but they built it on old foundations. But anyway, top picture's on the outside. The bottom picture's on the inside. So it's not like a gate on a fence. It's more like a street or a hallway, and if you're going into town, this is prime real estate. You're going to want to have a shop here, right? Obviously, so there's always stuff going on. Martha and I were at the Damascus Gate on a Friday. That's the Muslim worship day. And in the morning, we were there about, 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon. In the morning at the sermons in the mosque, they were all riling up the Palestinians. Something happened where two Jewish Israeli soldiers were chasing a couple Palestinian teenagers right in here. It's more of an open area now. And one of the Israeli soldiers slipped. The clip snapped out of his M16 and hit hard and ejected all the bullets out on the pavement. So it turned from kind of a growling situation to, let's laugh at the Israeli soldier, down on his hands and knees, picking up his bullets, putting them back in the clip. It was like day to night. It was kind of a fun thing to watch. So anyway, that's what the gate looked like. That's probably what the people looked like. This is a 100-year-old photo. So it was crowded, congested, things going on, animals in and out. So that's the scene. I think this is the last. Is this the last one, Ben? Yeah, that's the last one. Okay, you can turn this off now. So let me read you a few verses. Curses one who distorts the justice due a stranger, an orphan, a widow. Okay, this is in Deuteronomy. Another one. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf, that's a bundle of grain with the stalk, sheaf in the field, you are not to go back and get it. It shall belong to the stranger, the orphan, and to the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. So if you were a farmer and had a crop, if you dropped it, there's more regulations on this. If you dropped it, you had to leave it for the gleaners. You couldn't go back and pick it up. This is, in essence, a welfare tax. Okay? Now I'm just going through some things to catch up. Ruth is one of two books in the Bible named after women. So I'll tell you a joke to help you remember it. There was a preacher trying out, and he opened with this joke, and he had a dog with him. And he said, okay, when Jesus and the disciples were out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee and the wind started blowing, what was the water like? And the dog went, roof, rough, rough. He said, well, when Peter got up on top of the roof, on the top of the house and saw the vision, what did he see? And the dog went, roof, roof. Says, okay, two books in the Bible named after women. Name the one that's the Jewish woman. And he said, Ruth. And they kicked him out of the church. And as they were walking across the parking lot, the dog looked up and said, Esther? Okay. Two books in the Bible named about women. Ruth was not a Jew. Okay. There's four women in Jesus' genealogy. Ruth is one, Rahab, Tamar, and Bathsheba. In some way, Rahab, Ruth, and Tamar are referenced in the book of Ruth. That's interesting. That's a little detail. Let me see if anything else. Okay. Now, kinsman redeemer. So if a man dies and leaves a widow, okay, so Elimelech dies and his son dies, his sons die, his family line will end. Well, she can go to the next nearest kinsman and say, redeem me, and he has to buy back the land that her husband sold and possibly marry her, and then her child then will have that land will go off in Elimelech's name, not the new husband's name. So here's the passage. It's in Deuteronomy 25:7-10. If a man does not desire to take his brother's widow, then his brother's widow shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, you saw the gate. This is a busy place. So here's this upset woman going there making a scene, and she's going to make a bigger scene. So she goes to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He's not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of the city shall summon him and speak to him. If he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's widow shall come up to him in the sight of the elders. Okay, so the brother's widow, this woman goes up to this man, wants to back out on this. Go up to him, pull his sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and shall decree. This is what is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And in Israel, the family will be called by the name the house of him whose sandal was removed. How's that for a legal transaction? Wrestle him to the ground, pull his sandal off, and spit in their face.
Okay. Bethlehem, also called the House of Bread, that's what Bethlehem means. You saw it's about 10 to 15 miles from Jerusalem. Pastor C brings out the lambs in Bethlehem are bred for the Passover. No doubt the wheat's grown for the Passover bread. So there's good trade between the two. Two harvests, barley and wheat harvest. Barley harvest is March and April. Wheat harvest is June and July. The reason this is odd, okay, now you all know the story of Ruth pretty well. So Boaz proposes to Ruth. Ruth proposes to Boaz, actually. They agree to get married during the barley harvest. And I'll try and point this out when we get to it. But then it says she gleans on into the wheat harvest. She's still a poor widow out there doing the welfare thing, and she's engaged to the richest man in town. Does this make sense? I discussed this with Victor, and he and I kind of are in agreement. If Ruth would marry Boaz during the barley harvest, then they would have a joint account, and they would have to leave 10% of the crop in the field for the poor people. If she stays unmarried, Matt likes this one, she's still a poor widow, and she can pick up that 10%, and then they get married and put it into the joint account. Did you know that was in there, Steve? Maybe, maybe not. More assumptions. The other thing, and this is probably more legitimate, I'm in the process right now of transferring some farmland from one tenant that rents it and pays me a share of the crop to another tenant that rents it and pays me a share of the crop. But growing crops belong to the original tenant. So it's divided in two pieces. So the north half of this piece of property cannot be transferred this summer because it has growing crops. And to tell you how much growing crops are, the crops haven't even been planted. He's just prepping the soil to plant it. But he has the right to that crop, so that doesn't transfer for a full year now. And I went back to the Bible, actually. The way I got this piece of land, a man called me and said, the land's for sale. I will help arrange the purchase if you let me continue to farm it. Because the original owner doesn't want to own it anymore. And I said, that's fine. That farmer died 10 years ago. But his wife was still alive. I really wanted it. It would be better if I could have transferred it, but I wasn't going to take land away from a widow. So she died this last fall, and her son-in-law is farming it, and he wants to reduce his size of operation anyway. So we're doing a transfer. But I kept her on as a widow, even though she was incapable of hardly walking. But through her son-in-law, she could farm it. So bringing it up to common. Okay, talked about Mennonites and Ammonites. Naomi. Naomi could have been as young as 33 to 35. Assuming she was 15 when she gave birth the first time, and her son that got married and died was around 20, put around 33, 35 to 40. She was still able to bear children. This is important. So who is the widow that could request the kinsman redeemer? Was it Naomi or Ruth? This is interesting. We'll see it in the story. Okay. So let's get into the book of Ruth now. Has anybody learned anything new yet? That's kind of interesting. So don't go to Arabia and make frankincense jokes, okay? So in the first chapter, I won't read the chapter, but she talks about Elimelech and Naomi get married. There's a famine in Bethlehem. They go to Moab. They have two sons. They're there for 10 years. And then all the men die, so Naomi decides to go back to Bethlehem. And she tells the two daughters-in-law to stay. They're both Moabites. Now remember, the Moabites are pagans, and they sacrifice children. I did not find this in any of the reference books, but I was thinking, is it possible that Ruth had a baby and it was sacrificed? Possibly. Okay? So keep that in mind. Naomi says in here, if I were to have a husband tonight and give birth to sons, would you wait until they're old enough? Obviously not. So she says, go back to Moab and get married. Now, Ruth says, I will stay with you. And this is a set of verses used in weddings, but it's actually between a daughter-in-law and a mother-in-law. She says, do not plead with me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go, where you sleep, I will sleep. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. She might be fed up with paganism. I could see that. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and worse, if anything but death separates me from you. It's a good wedding vow, but it was between two women, actually. Naomi then takes Ruth, and they go back to Bethlehem. It was not a fun journey. It was going down to the Dead Sea level and then back up. I've been there. It'd be a rough trip, several days. Okay. Now, the actual story, I think, actually takes place in just a few days. Not a long period of time, actually just a few days. And I don't think it was a love story. Okay. So let's start reading here. So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab. Notice how many times they talk about Ruth being from Moab or being a Moabitess. Okay, they probably all looked alike, but they used labels back then. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain, following one in whose eyes I may find favor. So some farmers probably didn't allow the gleaning. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she left and gleaned in the field after the reapers, or behind the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and one reference said he might have been coming in from a war. Get the timing on this. If his father is Salmon, and Salmon married Rahab, Joshua wouldn't be long dead if he was dead at all, and Boaz might have been part of the conquering armies. That's not an assumption. It doesn't give the details here. Now, behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, may the Lord be with you. And they said to him, may the Lord bless you. Again, he treated his employees well. Then Boaz said to his servant, who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And the servant in charge of the reapers replied, she is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and has remained from morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while. They would construct little shelters so you could get in the shade. Then Boaz said to Ruth, listen carefully, my daughter. Okay, that's an indication that Boaz was probably older. Doesn't say Boaz might have had another wife. They did that back then, but we don't know for sure. Do not glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go from this one, but join my young women here. Keep your eyes on the field which they reap, and after them, indeed. Indeed, I have already ordered that my servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink what the servants draw. Now, this doesn't sound like much, but the pottery, they use pottery jars or animal skins. Probably pottery jars in this case. They were porous clay, and the reason for that, if you've all had a swamp cooler, if you have evaporating moisture on the outside, it will keep the water on the inside cooler. They had stuff figured out back then. They weren't stupid. But if she could drink Boaz's water, she didn't have to haul water from home. She didn't have to haul a water container home, which meant she could haul more grain home. They were hand-carrying everything. Okay? Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, which is a common Asian custom, and said to him, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner? Boaz replied to her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and land of your birth and came to the people that you did not previously know. Now, how did Boaz know all that? It's a small town. Remember the joke? In a small town, when you dial a wrong number, you'll talk for 20 minutes. Okay? They gossip back then. May the Lord reward your work, and may your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And the word for wings also means cover. We'll see that later. Then she said, I found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not like one of your female servants. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. Okay, when you process wine, it turns into wine, and then it turns into vinegar. This is the end of the year. It's about 10 months since the grape harvest, so all you have left in the neighborhood is vinegar. Besides that, does anybody take French bread and put some olive oil and sometimes salad vinegar in it and dip the bread in it? Anybody ever do that? What do you call oil and vinegar anyway? Salad dressing. How about croutons at a restaurant with yourself? So that's basically what they were doing. So Boaz provided her lunch, so he's spending money on her, providing her water, watching out for her security. So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain. She ate and was satisfied and had some left that she stuck in her pocket and took home. You'll see that later. When she got up to glean, Boaz commanded his servant, saying, let her glean among the sheaves and do not insult her. Now, this is important. A gleaner would go in after the harvesters had passed through the field. He said, let her work in the field while we're cutting. So that's an extension there. Also, you were to properly slip out for her some grain from the bundles and leave it so she may glean. And do not rebuke her. Don't tease her. Don't say anything bad. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she'd gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. That's about 30 pounds. She picked it up and went into the city. 30 pounds. I'm too lazy to carry that across the hallway, okay? She also took out some and gave to Naomi and what she had left, and she was satisfied. Her mother-in-law then said to her, where did you glean today, and where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz. Okay. You ever heard the term, it takes two people for a successful marriage? A willing daughter and a pushy mother? Naomi was a pushy mother. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed to the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness from the living and from the dead. And Naomi said to her, this man is our relative. He is one of our redeemers. I don't think Ruth understood the details of the law. Naomi did. Remember that tax evasion? What's the difference between tax evasion and tax avoidance? Jail. Okay, so we're talking about tax avoidance here. So Naomi knew the game. I don't think Ruth did to the detail that's going on, and you'll see this here. I'll try and wrap this up pretty quick. Then Ruth the Moabites. So anyway, I'll skip some parts here. Naomi sets it up. She says, Ruth, one night, she says, Ruth, wash yourself, perfume yourself. The harvest, the barley harvest has ended. Boaz will be out on the threshing floor. One of the commentaries said the threshing floor was probably leased out at various times, so you had your time, okay? So she took a bath, put on perfume, put on her best clothes, probably a cloak also. That was referred to, so nobody could recognize her. And she was to go out after dark and do something. So let's get the scene set. We have a pile of grain. There's thieves in the country, so the men would – this is – how it happened. The men would sleep with their head to the pile of grain and their feet extending out and circle the grain. So you had the harvesters and the supervisor. They were celebrating, so they had been eating a lot and possibly drinking. Now, I don't know how much alcohol was in it because it was the end of the year and that probably evaporated out. But they were still happy at a good harvest and full and tired. And the night cooled off, so they were sleeping good. So she lays down her feet to his feet. You got this? Okay. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all her mother-in-law had commanded her. Let me go back here. Okay. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything according. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she secretly came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. They think what she did is she laid down, kind of sat down, grabbed his cloak that was keeping him warm, pulled it off of him onto her. She covered herself with his cloak. Okay? Now, if you're sleeping, 50 degrees, and you get your covers jerked off of you, what are you going to do? wake up. And you can imagine a bunch of men, you know, cowboys would do this. They'd play tricks on each other. So he wakes up. Okay, he's playing games. So, happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled, bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. How did he know she was a woman? Remember, she perfumed herself? People, you could identify them in the dark by their smell in this culture. So, unusual. So he said, "Who are you?" And she answers, "Dark. Who are you?" She answered, "I am Ruth, your slave." This is important. Are slaves eligible for inheritance? No. What do you call a slave wife? A concubine. The difference between a concubine and a wife, the concubine's children are not entitled to the inheritance. So she calls herself a slave, not worthy of an inheritance. Okay? So she answered, "I'm Ruth, your slave. Now spread your garment over your slave, for you are a redeemer." What she is saying there is, you buy back the land my father-in-law sold, and it becomes the property of me and my children. That's what it means. I am not certain she thought she was proposing for marriage. Okay? Then he said, "May you be blessed," and he says, goes on and says, "Yes, I'll do it. But there is another redeemer closer than me." And this is what I think, for an assumption, his father would be a brother to Elimelech. He's only a nephew. He says, if the other kinsman doesn't agree to do the redemption, I'll do it. Now, the redeemer has to be willing. Remember I read you before, if you're not willing, you get your sandal jerked off and the woman spits in your face. Has to be willing and able. He has to have money in his pocket. Okay? So let me read this last passage and then we'll go into the ring. So she laid his feet until morning and got up before one person could recognize another. Still dark, and he said, "Do not let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor." He gives her grain, and she goes in to her mother-in-law. When she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did it go, my daughter?" And she told him all the man had done for her. She also said, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me." It's about 60 pounds. Okay. Then Naomi said, "Wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it today." So Naomi tells, in essence, Ruth, lay down and take a nap, and Naomi's out the door. She's headed to the gate because she knows the show's going to happen. So Boaz sits there, waits for the other redeemer to come, and says, "Ruth said she wants redemption. So you want to buy Naomi's land?" And he says, "Sure." And Boaz pops the good one. "Well, with the land comes Ruth, you've got to marry her." And the kinsman redeemer says, "I can't do that. It will destroy or mess up my inheritance." Now think, if Salmon marries Ruth and they have a child, so they've taken the inheritance Boaz is going to get to fund the purchase of this piece of land, and then it's going to go to another child. If Boaz marries Ruth, it stays with Boaz, because Boaz's son will also be Ruth's son. Does that make sense? So the other kinsman redeemer is saying, it makes more sense for you to do it than me to do it, and it keeps our inheritance intact. Besides, you like her. She's cute. Okay? So it goes on. So Boaz then marries Ruth, and we have the descendants going to David and ultimately to Jesus. The point I want to make, though, is Ruth, with the concept of grace, grace is you get something you don't deserve. Okay, so Ruth gets an inheritance, and her son gets an inheritance that normally a slave wouldn't receive. That's grace. Mercy is you don't get something you deserve. You've done something worthy of punishment, you don't get punished. So this is an illustration of grace. So we go back to the passage here, Hebrews, and then I'll end up with Romans. See if this doesn't fit this story perfectly. Blessed be the God of our Father, our Lord Jesus Christ. He is our kinsman redeemer. Is he willing and able to forgive us our sins and give us eternal life? Yes. Okay, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that's his ability to do it from the dead, to what? Obtain an inheritance. So the inheritance exists. An inheritance existed for Ruth, but what did she have to do? She had to ask for it. That's all. That's like we are. We believe in Jesus and trust in him, and we have this great inheritance of eternal life. So I'll finish this passage. To obtain an inheritance which is imperishable, undefiled, and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are protected by the power of God through faith for a salvation that will be revealed at the last time. Okay? Now close with Romans chapter 4, and this is in reference to an actual verse in Psalms. But to the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is credited as righteousness, just as David also speaks of the blessing of the person to whom God credits righteousness apart from his works. What did Ruth do to earn that inheritance? Nothing. She claimed it. Okay, so here's the verse. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds have been forgiven and whose sins have been covered. You see the symbolism of the covering? So the book of Ruth is one of the best salvation books I know of in the Bible, in the Old Testament. So I praise God that we have an inheritance from Jesus, and if you want that inheritance, you trust, put your trust in Jesus, that he will be your redeemer. Let's pray.